I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a new project that we've launched called unmistakableposters.com. Every month, we'll be shipping a brand new poster. If you love the artwork from our brand, now you can have some of it hanging in your studio or your office. Our first poster is the 15 Principles of an Unmistakable Standard. You can learn more and order your copy at unmistakableposters.com. Now, let's get into the episode. As an NYU undergraduate, Matan Grafel had aspirations of a career in finance, but getting rejected from over 100 jobs drastically altered the course of his career, ultimately leading to the launch of the Y Combinator startup 1 month. Matan, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Srini.
Yeah. So I came across you by way of our mutual friend, Sarah Peck, who was a guest here. And when she told me about the work that you're doing around accelerated learning and the startup that you're working on, I thought this is highly, highly relevant to anybody who's making anything. Mm-hmm. So I figured we had to get you on the show. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, and how that has brought you to the work that you're doing in the world today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's been such a long and crazy journey, and there's a lot of different things that I think were important. But I'll start with college because I'm actually 26 years old. I'm sort of 4 years out of college, and I went to NYU in New York City, and I started studying finance. Because in high school, it just like was playing around with investing a little bit of like money and stocks. And so I thought business would be like the thing for me. That's where I thought I'd make a lot of money. And it was fine. Like I found myself doing well in all the classes, but I really didn't enjoy the actual, I guess maybe culture is the word. Like I just didn't like talking about stocks with like people over dinner. It bored me, or it was... And also you see all these people who are successful in that career and none of them are like happy with their lives. I try to model the people that I admire. I try to find people who are happy and kind of like, pick bits of their life and try to follow what they did. And all of the people who were successful in finance that I talked to, who had become like managing directors at like Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or whatever, like very few of them were super happy and fulfilled with what they were doing. And to me, that was a huge red flag that like everyone around me was ignoring. A friend of mine kind of inspired me to make this shift. He was studying economics and philosophy as a double major. And so I realized that in my degree, I could actually take these 40 elective credits that they gave you and fill those up with a philosophy degree, basically. So I decided to do a double major in finance and philosophy, which was amazing. I mean, thinking about stuff in a totally different way. It definitely didn't help me get a job coming out of college, though. I graduated in 2010, and it was a time when the financial industry was not doing so well. But I also think there's something more than that. Like I applied to something like 100 jobs my senior year of college. I remember I had an Excel spreadsheet of every single one, and I got rejected from every single job that I applied to, which was really tough for me. Like it made me really question my self-worth. I did fine in school, right? So I couldn't really even blame it on like bad grades or anything. It was almost something about me personally. And I kept seeing people around me getting these jobs, getting these kind of dream, positions in investment banking at Morgan Stanley or Goldman or wherever it was. And these are people who I always felt were like less qualified than me. I think maybe that's like a really egotistical way to put it, but like I was just wondering, like, well, what do these people have that I don't have? So eventually I kind of got over it. I was certainly still like desperate to find some way to make money. So after graduating, I ended up asking my cousin, actually, who runs a sales team at Condé Nast, publishing, I asked him if he would give me a job as a salesperson, and he said no. He said they actually don't hire entry-level salespeople, but he actually said, well, my friend works at this startup and you should talk to him. And so he introduced me to this startup in New York City. It was called AppSavvy, and they were doing advertising, like a technology. They were putting brands inside of social games. I didn't know anything about that. And I think it's the whole world of advertising is like really confusing and totally foreign to people at first. And this company, the only position that they had open was like marketing. You know, I interviewed with the CEO. It was a total like 180 from what I was expecting that I'd be doing in investment banking, with like, you know, the culture of models and bottles and making like hundreds of thousands your first year out of college, and just the crazy sort of debauchery that they depicted that I was always expecting, going to working at a startup with like a bunch of 20-year-olds who were just like really committed, but getting paid honestly peanuts compared to what my friends were making. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know anything about marketing, but I guess at the time they were just like, we like you, and you know, we need someone to do newsletters, and we need someone to do sort of whatever, like random odds and ends, just different ideas that they had. So I was like, yes, hire me and I will learn how to do all that stuff. Like, don't worry about it. And so because I really wanted to get good at that, and I going into it, I had this sort of like mentality that I wanted to become a director, like a director level person within a year. And I think that was probably a little bit aggressive. I remember telling my boss that like my intention was to become director of marketing within a year. And he laughed because he was like this, 35-year-old who had been doing this stuff his entire life and was used to this, like the corporate background where it takes you 2 years to get into like the, senior level. I was marketing coordinator at the time. So it was like, marketing manager and then director of marketing. I kind of wanted to skip all of that because I knew that I was smart and I knew that like I could get good at this. And so I just kind of wanted to prove myself and kind of be the exception. I don't know like where that drive comes from, but like I've always sort of felt like there's, you don't have to get stuck doing the same path as everyone else does, because sometimes you can find little tricks and shortcuts or just work extra hard and get somewhere faster. So that's when it was in that role where I first discovered some of the like the online learning tools that were really young at that time. There was General Assembly in New York City, which is it was a co-working space, but they were also offering like night classes one day a week. And so a friend told me about that, and I started taking like marketing for startups classes and advertising 101 classes, and just bringing everything, just sucking it up like a sponge and bringing it back with me to this role, and keeping the stuff that worked and throwing out the stuff that didn't work. And it was just like surrounding myself with all these resources. And I think that first year, like I like to say, that first year I was there, I probably learned more than I did in the entire 4 years in college beforehand. And a lot of it was the fact that like it wasn't just conceptual; it was this company on the line. I ended up after a year and a half managing a marketing budget of about $500,000. I organized my first like full conference with over 150 brands from around the world. We won a Guinness World Record for one of the campaigns that we did, which I thought was pretty cool. I really enjoyed like learning this new thing, learning it through General Assembly, through Skillshare, through Udemy, through iTunes University, just all these resources that were available that like very few people knew about, and also connecting with the teachers there. That was a huge benefit of a lot of these classes for me, was that they were taught by like seasoned professionals who were often doing the job still. They weren't like professors who were teaching full time. And so I would walk up to them afterwards and get their information and ask them out to lunch and sort of pick their brains. And a lot of those are still mentors to this day. Actually, one of them was a was our first investor in this company that I started. So after about a year and a half of doing this marketing thing, it stopped being a challenge. It started being that I realized that it was more of the same that was expected of me. You know, looking back at the year and a half before, there was all of this new stuff that I'd done, and then looking forward on the year and coming up with projections. I think it was about the end of the year, like projection time. What they wanted from me was, we did one conference, let's do four this year. We won these awards, let's win more next year. Let's just do more of the same. And to me, that felt like that just felt kind of like stagnation, because after learning all this stuff the year before, I didn't see anything that I'd be learning moving forward. And on top of that, I started doing a lot for the company, and it was never really appreciated. I think there was always this aspect of I don't know if the word is ageism, but because they looked at me and my age, even within this startup, the mentality was, you'll be director of marketing when you've been doing this for a few years, which always, it seemed arbitrary to me. Because it was like, I'm already doing the role of this thing, but they just didn't, they sort of didn't want to appreciate it for that. And I also at that point read 4-Hour Work Week, which I've talked to a lot of people about since. And it seems like Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week was like the starting point for a lot of different entrepreneurial careers. I'm not even sure he realizes how many it was. So I fell in love with this idea reading that book of constantly learning, which I was already doing a bit of, but like just dedicating the rest of your life to learning a new thing and traveling, to a new place every 6 months, and the idea of passive income, which sounds really nice. It didn't end up becoming that. But when I quit that job, was a scary moment, but I quit it, and I had a few different ideas for companies I wanted to start. There was a brain supplement that I created, which actually was literally what Tim Ferriss did. There was a strategy guide book that I was testing out for Farmville, and there was this software idea that I came up with, which I thought was actually a really great idea. I just didn't actually know how to build it. I knew what it was, but I there was something stopping me, in the way of me being able to execute it. So for a while, I went around to different events trying to find some developer, trying to bring on a technical co-founder who could build it for me, and I couldn't. It was very frustrating. Looking back at wasting 3 months trying to find someone to do this thing for me and realizing I hadn't actually achieved progress in a number of months on any of this stuff. I was having lunch with a friend of mine named John who told me about actually his experience learning how to code. He had taught himself how to code in high school. And so he'd said, you're going to have to learn how to do this thing because no one else is going to help it happened. No one cares about your idea but you. So if you're not going to make it happen, it's not going to happen. And I think that's when I realized, I would absolutely have to learn how to do this thing, which never really seemed like an option to me before for some reason. So that unlocked this drive to learn how to code. But because I didn't really want to take an entire year to learn that. I also couldn't afford to do that. I hadn't really saved up much money. I ended up packing up my bags and moving to San Francisco for 1 month to learn to code. That was my goal, was I'm going to give myself a month, go through all of these different resources that John had written down for me. I'm going to try to go through them as fast as possible and have an actual working product by the end of it. And I managed to do that. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing experience. It was just, when I look back at my life, I think that month had some of the highest highs and lowest lows that I'd ever felt. There was one time where I tried to install, upgrade my version of Ruby, and it just broke everything on my computer for 2 days. So for 2 days, I just, from 9 to 5, I was just trying to figure out what the hell was going on, and nothing was working. And it was like I was sweating because I felt like I had single-handedly broken something, and I had no idea what it was, and I had no idea how I would find the answer. But when I did finally fix it, after 2 days of like struggling, it was just this amazing high. You know, it was like, it felt like a drug or something. And just coding was this totally new experience to me, where there are just many moments of that. Like, it's always something's broken, and then you fix it and you're flying high, and then there's that next, you know, thing that you run up against, and then it's like this really low again. So I ended up building this prototype, and unfortunately, it turned out there wasn't really a market for it. People, you know, it was hard to actually connect with customers. But from that experience, I ended up going back to New York, and friends of mine started asking me how I learned how to code, because I had a lot of other friends that had ideas that were like maybe business majors in college, and they couldn't find technical co-founders. And so initially I started, it started as actually a series of blog posts where I just, I sort of went through my thinking process about why I decided to learn how to code and what the path that I found was and what the resources that I found were, and like why I chose Ruby on Rails as a programming language. And those, out of those three blog posts came a class that I started teaching at General Assembly. And the class just really hit on something that I think people were really curious about. Maybe it was just like timely, right? This whole learn to code movement, which started to take off in the last few years. So this class, you know, it went from first like 20 students to 30 to 40, and it was selling out like week after week. And I mean, I never thought I would be teaching, but the whole teaching experience started to become really addictive to me. I remember it was like super nerve-wracking the first day, where they, you know, there's this classroom full of people, and everyone was older than me. It was all like people in their 30s, people in their 40s who were maybe like not satisfied with their careers or had a startup that they wanted to start. They were all kind of like looking for this answer, and I was, you know, I really doubted whether I could actually provide that answer. I was just like a 24-year-old kid, right? And I wasn't a coder per se. I had just like a month before started on my own path. And so part of me always felt like I was like, you know, like an imposter. You hear about imposter syndrome with entrepreneurs, but I kind of felt that way. But at the same time, there was a moment during the first class where once you push through that like embarrassment or that fear, where, you know, you're speaking in front of the room and everyone's sort of like skeptical, like, what does this person actually have to offer to me? Where a switch flips, and you could see it, like people physically change the way that their bodies look, from like, you know, going from crossed arms to open, and they would actually start asking questions because they actually care, and they realize that like maybe you know a little bit of something that would be useful to them. And then they ask questions about their ideas, and I think I fell in love with that moment. So I started, you know, teaching that, and I started teaching more classes. I started teaching about growth hacking, which was this new term that I had heard come out of like Silicon Valley, and it was kind of this marketer coder hybrid, you know, like a coder responsible for getting more users for a product. And because I had this background in marketing, but also had just learned how to code, it was something that I felt like I could speak to. So I started teaching about that. I'll skip through some of this stuff, but I ended up creating a Skillshare class back when Skillshare was first doing online classes. And I never really expected it to be very big. I sort of thought if I could fit 40 people in a room, well, maybe I could teach 100 people in an online class, make a little bit of extra money, and reach a little bit more people. And so that was my goal, was to get like to teach this 100-person online class. And that first class that we set up ended up having 2,000 students. It totally, you know, hit me by surprise. I think it hit Skillshare by surprise. They had never had a class that was bigger than 200 students. And that was the day, like literally everything changed. I, I was probably actually running out of money at that point. I was definitely running out of money. I remember I had $200 left in my checking account, and I knew that that next week, if something didn't come in, like I would have to find a job. And I went to one of my sort of advisors, mentors at the time, who was one of my first teachers, and asked him, like, do you have any work that I could do for you? Because I really need it. And that next week, the Skillshare class was just super successful. And it suddenly had made like $40,000 in revenue. And I was like, oh my God. So, and then I got nervous about the class, of course. I pitched the class before I even had any of the curriculum like developed. And then when I actually recorded it, I only got about halfway through the recording of the stuff. And I always thought that people would like call me out as being a fraud because I didn't even have the whole curriculum done. It was supposed to be a month. The class was called How to Teach Yourself to Code, 1 Month Rails. And I only really did like 2 weeks worth of content. And so I kind of like padded it with like the last week being go off and like explore and do your own project and sort of extended the rest of the week. But I thought to myself, like, if I thought that this class would be okay for like a 40-person class, then why am I suddenly doubting myself now that it's like a 2,000-person class? Plus, there was so much going on, I didn't even have the time to redo it. So I decided to just run with it and see what happened. And people loved it. Like, the response was incredible. You know, the response, I started getting emails from people about like how they had tried to learn how to code before and nothing had ever worked. And they were frustrated with all the resources. And I didn't just create a class to create another class. I created it because in my own experience of going through these things, they were all so convoluted, or like none of them spoke to me as a beginner. None of them spoke to what I wanted to learn. Like, I actually wanted to build something, and I actually had all these questions that none of these resources answered because they were all written as if you already like knew this stuff. There's this idea that I've sort of become obsessed with, which is like the internalization of knowledge. And as an expert, you often learn all of these things that like you didn't know when you were first starting out, and you learn them, and because they become second nature, you forget that they're even things that you learned in the first place. And so when you then have to teach beginners, you skip over some of the most important stuff because you have this idea of like the right way to teach it, but it's very hard for you to sort of externalize these processes that have for you have become second nature. And so because I wasn't an expert, I think I actually maybe was like better suited for teaching beginners how to do this stuff. Like, I remembered what it was like for me still to not know this stuff. And so the first class was like showing people how to actually build Pinterest from scratch. And the feedback, like the emails as they kept flowing in were like, you know, this is amazing. Like, people told me that they were able to like leave their jobs and get jobs as like designers. A lot of people have gone on to become developers and make twice their salary or start their startups or do whatever that was like their dream. And at least that spoke to me really, really strongly, because I've always felt like people shouldn't blame the world around them for not letting them do the things that they really want to do. Like, there are so many people going around saying, you know, if only my boss appreciated me more, or if only I was getting paid more, then I could, you know, live the life I really wanted to live. Or like, I will write that book when I retire, you know? But like, those are all just internal. Like, those are like these limiting beliefs. Mm-hmm. That just always bothered me. So that was, I think, another big reason why I created the class, because I wanted people to realize, like, no, this is up to you. And if you're complaining that you can't build your company because you can't find a developer, then, you know, it's really never going to happen. So you have to figure this out on your own. So that ended up, actually in total, I ended up having 6,000 people because I ran that class twice. And then, I applied to Y Combinator with that, and Y Combinator accepted me, which was a crazy experience because I had applied before and gotten rejected for, you know, the first time around when I first learned how to code. And I went through Y Combinator with built up this team. And from there, the next obvious question was like, well, if we could teach Ruby on Rails in a month, what else can we teach in a month? So the company kind of shifted this idea, and which is where the name came from, 1 month. And we've developed, at this point, 6 classes. Mm-hmm. 1 month Rails, 1 month HTML and CSS, 1 month iOS for app development. And then we started looking outside of just coding to like 1 month growth hacking, which is kind of like digital online marketing with like a bit of a technical bent. And now we're even, you know, expanding further. We're thinking like 1 month content marketing, 1 month sales, like possibly 1 month happiness. Mm-hmm. Like I really think a lot about, you know, how can you get there faster? How can you prove people wrong?
Yeah.
Right? Because there's so many people who just take that standard path. Mm-hmm. So that sort of gets me to present day. We raised a little bit of funding to help support the team. We're here in New York City. There are 9 of us now. And in the last like year and a half, so much has changed.
All right. So there's a ton of stuff here.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to the very beginning.
Sure.
Starting with philosophy.
Yeah.
And how having that background in philosophy has influenced and shaped, your own worldview and the way you've navigated this entire path and journey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, so much. Like, I used to try to explain to people our teaching philosophy through this philosopher named Wittgenstein, which is a point I think I've stopped doing because it's like sounds elitist and it goes over people's heads. But Wittgenstein's one of my favorite philosophers, and he's this guy who totally like, he's very modern, right? Like within the last 100 years, and he came in without too much background in classic philosophy, and he just sort of turned everything upside down. But he's really, really hard to read. And in philosophy, they say actually like good philosophy is good despite being badly written and despite being convoluted, not because of it, which is, the point is be simple in your writing, be clear in your writing. You could still write good philosophy. But in this case, Wittgenstein is really dense and really hard to read. And so I used to struggle like getting even through this. Like you would read a paragraph and then by the end of it, you think you understand, but you actually have totally forgotten the point of what he's trying to make. And so one of my teachers told me that like the way that you should approach Wittgenstein is to skim the entire essay up front, to just like browse the whole thing and not really try to understand exactly what he's trying to do, but just try to get a sense of where he's going with this thing. And then once you know where he's going, when you go back to the beginning and you start reading it, it all starts to make a little bit more sense. Because you're not trying to understand what he's saying and also trying to figure out where he's going with it. And to me, with coding, that always seemed like the biggest problem for people, which is like all these resources out there, you just dive right into like these fundamentals, the core concepts of coding, things about like variables and strings and arrays and like these building blocks that you're supposed to eventually build up into these grand complex structures. But I get so frustrated as a beginner because I don't understand like why are we learning this stuff? You know, like what am I going to be able to do with it? And you can only keep someone's interest for so long with this boring fundamental building block stuff before eventually they just give up. And that's in education in general, I think that's the biggest shame. That's how we teach math today, right? That's how we teach most topics, where you start with addition and then you understand addition and you go move on to multiplication and then you move on to like you move on to calculus and it's just these layers upon layers. But at a certain point, you know, a kid always asks the teacher, like raises his hand. He's like, "Hey teacher, why do I need to know this stuff?" And the bad teachers or most teachers just say like, "Trust me, this will be useful later." Right? And at a certain point, most people just decide, "Well, actually, this is not really useful," which is why, you know, not everyone's a mathematician. And so it just kind of where you end there kind of decides your relationship with that topic for the rest of your life, which is why a lot of people just kind of give up in like third grade. And then for the rest of their life, they have this belief that they're just not math people, right? Or they're just not science-y people. Like, you know, I'm just not good at math or whatever. And a lot of those people actually don't think that they can learn how to code. I hear people all the time tell me, you know, I've always wanted to learn how to code, but I'm not really like a math person. I'm not good at math. So, you know, I don't think I'd be good at this thing. My ideal approach would be like, let's dive into actually using this stuff. Let's dive into like some real life situations, because once something is actually useful to you, you're much more interested in learning it. It's like going to this is why immersion learning with language works so well. It's like going to a new country and suddenly you have to learn the language because you're like going to starve otherwise, you know, if you don't know how to order pizza. And suddenly you're like, oh my God, that's how you say that thing. Yes, I've like, you unlock a whole part of the world for you. You make yourself happier. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the reasons why I think education's broken. And that's some of the thing we try to fix. Like, I assume people are lazy. I assume people get distracted easily. And so these courses that we create, you know, take that in mind. And we actually have people like starting to build their project on the first day, right on day one, so they can see the results of this stuff.
Amazing. So, you know, one other thing that really interested me is the fact that you made this spreadsheet of 100 jobs and you got rejected from all of them. And to deal with that sort of self-worth issue that you're talking about, I want to dig deeper into that a little bit, just so I can understand how you sort of separated your self-worth from the circumstances of your life in that moment, because it seems that that has been critical through this entire journey.
I think that your self-worth is often really, I mean, people compare themselves to everyone around them. It's like almost this unconscious thing, right? If you surround yourself with a certain set of people, you're going to be comparing yourself and like what you achieve against what they achieve. And so when I was in this, you know, finance program, and when everyone around me was, you know, getting that amazing job at you know, that amazing company, and in my entire life there, like, everyone thinks that they're special. So as a freshman, I remember thinking like, yeah, I'm going to get that job at Goldman Sachs. That's not a problem. Like, it's kind of like how everyone thinks they're going to be a millionaire, you know, by the time they're like 25 or 30 years old. And then when they don't get there, it's like, well, like, what's wrong with me? Right. It's just that contrast between expectations and what you get. And I think it definitely helped partially that I had this, you know, the philosophy, like, I wasn't just purely doing the finance thing. You know, it was quite existential. And looking back at it now, it seems, not only does it seem silly, it actually seems like amazing that it happened that way, because a lot of my friends who ended up doing finance have since left finance because it stopped, you know, I think actually it stopped being culturally sexy, right? There was the whole Occupy Wall Street thing and people really started looking down on people working in finance. And so people whose parents had been pushing them to get a great job in finance their whole life, like, maybe their parents weren't pushing them as hard to do it because, like, it, you know, their friends were starting to judge them for it. So people ended up going from these amazing jobs to like arguably less good jobs, but they were happier because of it, because they weren't working 100 hours a week, which was kind of like, you know, that's what you were supposed to be doing. You're supposed to give everything to this. And people in that program, I don't think it's healthy really, but they value their contribution to the world in terms of how much money they make. Yeah. Right? Like, they measure value. And so they say, they think, if I can become a millionaire, it means that I've contributed like $1 million worth of value to the world, mm-hmm. which is certainly debatable. Yeah. I don't think a lot of those feelings changed until time passed and I found myself in a different situation with, you know, people who were much happier. So it worked out for the best.
So,
I wish I could say I had some insight or something, but it literally was just, I couldn't get a job doing this.
Well, I think that's pretty normal, right? You run up against roadblocks and obstacles end up becoming something that, you know, opens another path entirely, which I think makes a perfect setup for my next question. Before we get into sort of the Y Combinator deal, is that, I mean, to me, it seems like one of the things that you have a real eye for is this ability to see opportunity where it doesn't seem like there is any. You know, you fail at creating a prototype for something, it doesn't resonate with the market, and that leads you into a Y Combinator startup, which is probably most founders' dreams. So I'm really interested in hearing, you know, how do we cultivate that in our own work when we run up against obstacles and roadblocks?
So, man, that's a good question. I think there's two parts of it. One is I try to put myself in situations where I have the potential to have a lot of different opportunities. Like for all of the things that work out, there's like at least 1,000 that didn't work out, and you don't even really recognize it after a while. Like, you know, it started with just getting a lot of coffee with people in New York City, just picking a lot of people's brains and trying a lot of things, right? Like I mentioned when I quit my job, I had these three different ideas of companies, and I didn't know which one of them would work out. And I honestly didn't know that the class would be as successful as it was. I think that was just being in the right place at the right time. And even in a lot of those cases, I didn't even realize I had hit opportunity until much later. I think that's the case for a lot of people. Like when this class was at General Assembly and it started selling out week after week of 40 people, I still taught that class for about 8 months before I ever had the idea to teach it as an online class. And it was just a way to make money on the side while I was pursuing these other things that like failed. There was that one moment where I kind of just looked back and thought, man, I'm such an idiot. I have this class that has people that are coming to it. They're paying me money. In some cases, they were coming up to me afterwards and saying, like, I want you to teach the follow-up class. I actually want to learn this stuff from you. And I would just go like, yeah, that sounds fun. Like, maybe I'll do that when I have the time. But I had just ignored it for so long that eventually I couldn't really stop. I couldn't really ignore it. Like I had to identify it. I think about it as like designing your life around serendipity, right? Like people talk about those once in a lifetime opportunities. And when you look at really successful people, you see the string of really unlikely series of events that happen. You know, it's like that one random thing and that other random thing. And it's easy to look at that from the outside and to say, man, that person's lucky. Like they're so lucky and I wish that I got those lucky breaks. But what you don't see is the thousands of other, you know, breaks that didn't happen for them, these situations they put themselves in. I think of it as like setting thousands of tiny little serendipity bombs and like 999 of them, you know, the fuse will go out before anything happens. And so it's just about being there and ready for the one that does work out.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing is just, you know, self-improvement is so important for me. And I try to think more long-term. And so if some decision is going to make me better in general, which coding was definitely one of those things, you know, I didn't know if that would be useful immediately, but I just knew if I learned this thing, well, like 5 years from now or 10 years from now, I'll know something new. It'll make me a more valuable person. Like how do I learn things that are not going to pay off necessarily tomorrow, but like maybe a year from now or maybe 10 years from now?
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit.
Sure.
First, you know, I want to hear about the Y Combinator experience in depth from the perspective of a founder, because I mean, I think that, you know, we can read about it endlessly. There's 1,000 blog posts on it, you know, all over the web from founders who've been through it. But to actually hear it in an interview form, I think would be really interesting. And I'm just really curious about the whole process and experience and how that has altered and shaped the way you do things and the way you show up in the world and, you know, the way you are as a founder today because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I could kind of cleanly divide my life into before Y Combinator and after Y Combinator. It's totally different and things have certainly accelerated since then. So they call Y Combinator an accelerator for a reason. I mean, it's supposed to bring in startups and then sort of spit them out at like a much more advanced stage where you kind of grow the equivalent of like 3 years worth of time within 3 months. For me going into it, I didn't really know all of that stuff. I don't think I really understood it. I didn't know what the structure was, honestly. To me, it was on one hand, like validation, like You know, it's like applying to Harvard and getting in. Like, you want, there's an ego to it. Like, you want that validation. I also thought, well, if I'm a Y Combinator startup, it'll be easier to attract good talent. You know, it'll be easier to get press about us. It'll be easier to raise money. And so it's, you know, you're more likely to make the company succeed. So from the rational perspective, yeah, it makes sense. But going into it, when I first got there, like, they did this kickoff session, and I got there. I brought in a co-founder into Y Combinator, who is my co-founder to this day, once I got accepted. And I remember the two of us sort of showing up and like asking, okay, so like, where are the sessions? Like, where do I go on Monday morning? And like, what's the plan? And they're like, no, there is nothing. There's no, you know, you're not showing up for school or anything. There are no lectures. It's just, you're here. We're going to give you about $20,000, which is going to help you rent a room. And it's going to help you basically pay for food, but not much else, and like a car. And you're going to be, you know, you're going to be working on your company, like, for the entirety of the time that you're here. And the only like formal part of Y Combinator, there were three things. There was a weekly dinner that happened on Tuesday nights, and it was then where everyone came to the space. I thought it was like a co-working space initially, but no one worked out of there. You weren't actually allowed to. It was only on Tuesday nights where all the companies in the batch came in. There were about 60 in my batch. Everyone showed up. We ate this kind of sludge food. It was always like a crock pot with rice and then like some sort of stew, like really economical, right? But not really, nothing fancy. And you would reconnect with the other founders. It was actually really needed, because you'd spend the last 7 days literally working by yourself in like your room in your apartment or your house. So you kind of took this opportunity to socialize a little bit. And then they would invite an amazing speaker. They had great connections. They brought in Mike Bloomberg or Jerry Yang, who founded Yahoo, or Mark Zuckerberg, Ron Conway from SV Angel, Ben Silberman, who started Pinterest. They just brought in some of the most amazing founders who had incredible stories. It was mostly just stories. They talk a lot. You know, they build it up as this thing where it's like totally off the records, right? And admittedly, you're not allowed to tweet about it, or you're not really supposed to share it with other people. So there's a more of a level of openness. But at the same time, it was much less about like sharing business secrets and much more about hearing the story of someone who triumphed against all odds. You know, and these people had been through equally hard, if not harder, situations than you were in. And so I just, week after week, left Tuesday nights just feeling totally re-energized and just feeling like, man, I just want to go back to work immediately. And I think those weekly dinners just literally served to like to motivate you through the entire program to not burn out. Mm-hmm. And just barely, even, because most people burn out by the end. But then on top of those dinners, there was a like, you could do office hours, which you could pick office hours with any of the partners. They have amazing partners on board. They had the CEO of Groupon, Andrew Mason. They have Paul Buchheit, who invented Gmail and also created the Google motto of "Don't be evil." You know, they just have really brilliant people as partners. But that's kind of optional. Like, you don't have to meet with partners if you don't want to. There's like a weekly group check-in, which they started playing around with, and then there's demo day at the end. And you, at demo day, it's kind of a misnomer. You only have 2.5 minutes on stage in front of a room full of investors to talk about your company.
Wow.
And that's it, right? And yet, it's so simple, but it's also so powerful. I think what they identified is that there's power in simplicity. Uh-huh. It's a really engineering kind of approach where it's like, you're trying to optimize for this thing, this 2.5 minute thing at the end, at demo day, and it's so constrained that like you don't have much to worry about. All you're trying to do up to that point is grow, and that's the number one question on everyone's mind throughout the entire program, is how much are you growing? Every time you met with a partner, it was, how much did you grow last week? There was this sort of unspoken rule that you want to grow at least 7% a week, week over week, And so if you can do that, if you can grow 7% every week while you're there, and the best companies, you know, grew 10% or 15% or 20% a week, but if you can just maintain 7%, then you end up at demo day with this beautiful looking like growth curve, and that's what the investors wanted to see. You know, and then you could do the funding, and then sort of, I guess there was always this assumption that if you got funding, like the rest would be fine, which it like there's really a lot more than that, but all of the decisions that you make while you're there come from this question of what's going to get me growth. Mm. And it's super simplifying. It's just like, should we hire this person? Well, is it going to help you grow this week? Should we redo the homepage? Is that going to help you grow 7% or not? So I think that's, you know, I think that was what was special about it.
So, you know, it sounds to me like it's almost a cultural illusion in Silicon Valley or in the startup world that getting into Y Combinator pretty much sets you up for life and it's all smooth sailing from there.
Yeah, well, yes and no. Like, there's certainly kind of a mafia. They hook you up with like a TechCrunch article to help you launch while you're there. So mm-hmm. they have that relationship built. They have relationships with good investors. I think a lot of the value there is they kind of have reshifted the balance between entrepreneurs and the VCs, which is, it used to be like, well, you're the startup and you're looking for money. And so you're pitching to the people who have money. You don't have much power in that situation. You know, they make the rules, they decide how much they want to invest. Cause like, you're going to die if you don't get the money.
Right.
But then Y Combinator turns it kind of into like a bit more of a union, which is to say like, if a venture fund treats you badly, if they tell you they're going to invest and then they don't invest, that's like a black mark. And actually, you can get blacklisted from investing in Y Combinator companies if you do that. Funds have done that before. And now like all of the YC companies are off limits for them. So companies, funds have started to realize that. And so when they hear that you're a Y Combinator company, the tone of the conversation changes because they know that there's, you know, you have sort of the weight of this entire thing behind you. It also generally, there's like a little bit of a valuation bump associated with it. So companies that raise money coming out of it, it's probably easier to raise money than it would be otherwise, and you get it at a higher valuation. But a lot of that is because they understand like the mentality of investors, and they structure the whole demo day thing in a way that kind of makes them compete over you, mm-hmm. right? So like really flipping the tables again instead of you competing over them. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly not, I mean, it really, really isn't that if you get in, you're set. I think that's like a very short-sighted way of looking at it. There were a lot of companies in our batch that broke up before they even got to the end. Wow. You know, founder fights. There were companies that weren't able to raise money going out of it. There were companies that ran out of money after it. There's really like only a handful of companies in my batch that I can point to that were like very successful coming out of it. And then a lot of companies that sort of are like doing pretty all right. Some of them are going to go bankrupt. Some of them will probably end up being really successful. Mm-hmm. You know, it just improves the odds a little bit.
Yeah. Well, sounds like just business in general, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
All right. So we're getting close to an hour and I'm wondering how quickly we're going to be able to do this, because I think this is a really interesting piece for our listeners. I want to take this accelerated learning framework and see if we can
sure.
boil it down into learning any skill, just sort of at a mm-hmm. meta level. And then, of course, mm-hmm. you know, we'll definitely link up onemonth.com and all your courses. But can
sure.
you extract the overall framework for us that has led to the formation of 1 month and really kind of is at the core of how you do this?
Yeah. So part of the difficult thing when you're learning something new is that you don't really understand like the vastness of the entire body of knowledge. So it's hard for you to construct, you know, like the order of how to learn stuff, or like what you should learn and what you shouldn't learn. That's where like good teachers really come in. But I think if you can, that's that like whole skill of being an autodidact. Those are people who are actually really good at like researching new topics and figuring out what they should learn and what they shouldn't. But I think a lot about it as like kind of habit development and change development. And you have to make it easy for yourself to change something in your life. I often actually like move to a totally different place when I'm learning something new, Because if you're trying to take any significant amount of time every day, like 30 minutes or an hour to do something a day, it's hard to fit that into a system that you already have set up. Like your body is, it tends to fight against you. It tends to want to just, you know, fall into the habits that you're used to, where instead of waking up early and practicing something, you kind of like, you hit snooze, or you just, instead of staying up late, like you grab a beer with your friend. So that's like why I went to San Francisco, or that's why I flew to Buenos Aires once for a month to work on a book, because I didn't know anyone there and my body didn't have any of these like ingrained things. So first I try to tell people, like, if you want to change your behaviors when you're learning something new, change the environment around you a little bit to make it easier for yourself. In terms of actually tackling a new topic, you want to think of like what's actually useful, and you don't want to necessarily come at it the way that it's been taught forever, because the traditional approach is like bottom up, and it's meant to give you a really solid foundation in something, but it also assumes you're going to be doing it for a long time, which you don't necessarily want to do. I think most people, like, they get bored easily. You want to find a project for yourself that you can actually use this thing on, that's not too big, right? That's kind of one of the trickier parts, where you could start applying this thing immediately, like from day one, and then just almost create like a list of things to tackle one at a time. And you don't know how you're going to start tackling those problems, but you have to start going down that list and you know, really start solving the problems. And the learning kind of happens along the way, right? That's how we construct the class, is we just start on day one. Let's build this application. It's like, all right, well, how do I build an application? Mm-hmm. Okay, like then you learn that thing. And then you move on to the next step of what you want to do. And not worrying so much about really full understanding. That comes with time and that comes with repetition. But getting a sense of the entire picture of where what you're trying to get to, it helps to identify like a bunch of resources that are good for beginners. But I think about it, I came up with this term that I call brute force learning, which is about like surrounding yourself with all these resources and going through a lot of beginner tutorials really quickly without getting stuck in any one of them. Like if you don't understand one of the concepts and one of the ways that it's teaching you, then just like going forward through it and just, you know, having faith that the next time around, it'll make a little bit more sense. Because a lot of people, I think, get stuck because they really, you know, they have good intentions where they want to understand this topic before moving on, but then they get distracted or they never end up understanding it. And that's where people generally give up. Of course, it helps to find people who you can sort of fall back on if you end up being really frustrated and you can't move forward. But, you know, first starting to dive into like a new topic will help you find those people, whether it's through meetups or whether it's through like online groups. You know, and then having those people kind of on speed dial for when you're like, I really broke stuff and I've been trying for a while and I'm frustrated. Can you help? And, you know, at least in coding, yeah, there are a lot of people like that out there, which, you know, I think people think that they're going to have to learn all this stuff on their own, which isn't true.
Well, this has been really, really fascinating, and it's been really cool to get a view into things that I've personally been very curious about, the Y Combinator experience. And I myself am now looking at some of your courses thinking, okay, there's app ideas that I've been playing around that I'm like, I have no idea how to do for years.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to probably sit down with one of your courses and start dabbling with it.
Cool.
But one final question for you, which is how we close all our interviews here at Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Man. Yeah, no, I was anticipating that question and I didn't plan an answer yet. So let's see. What makes someone unmistakable? I think it's something that like you feel different after talking to this person. You know, they change your perspective on your life, on your situation, on what you want to do. And for me, like the people that stand out that I've met are people that, you know, leave me either totally motivated to like learn something new or dive into a new area or give me a new perspective on something that like maybe I've been trying to tackle, but I haven't been able to do it. There are people who are just like super valuable. You know, they're helping people around them all the time and they're sort of giving off value. That's kind of, I think in my life, if I can just continue to put value outwards and not worry so much about like myself and getting myself to the next level, that's when I find actually that things, I'm much happier and things go much better for me, honestly, because people want to help people that want to help other people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, that makes plenty of sense.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Matan, it has been my absolute pleasure to have you here as a guest on the Unmistakable Creative. As I said, just an absolutely fascinating story. And we'll include links and resources to some of their courses. By the way, for those of you guys who don't know, I have included this in our newsletter. You guys are doing a 30-day writing challenge, right, to kick off the
year? That's right. And yeah, that's something that Sarah created.
A lot of people listening actually have aspirations to write a book, and this is a really great way to get started.
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic.
All right. And for those of you guys listening, we'll wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.